IT businesses in Sacramento, California.
From somewhere deep in the cloud and the corners of the earth, this is the Killing It Podcast, with a focus on helping you make sense and dollars of all things IT, with your hosts, Dave Sobel, Ryan Morris, and Carl Polachuk.
Welcome, everybody, to episode 76 of the Killing It.
Killing It!
Killing It!
Podcast. Almost. You're getting there. So, Ryan is the only one of us who actually got to travel, although Dave's got something planned. But Ryan is, like, hanging out by the lake, up in the woods in Lake Chelan, Washington.
I will say, you know, there comes a point where what you want to do and what you must do become the same thing. And this was that week where we finally arrived at the point of, I literally am going to go insane if I don't get out of my own four walls. So I did. And we came to a lake, and I will vouch for the fact that for those of you who are only hearing the audio version of this, it looks so good.
it was kind of mesmerizing watching the water in the background during our preparation. Oh, he turns the camera.
Camera to give us the water view while we're
just
talking.
Piss us off.
Exactly. Well, we're in our houses.
So I just go to my daughter's and prep for her wedding. But Dave, you've got something planned as well.
Well, it's the long weekend. We're gonna drive to the eastern shore of Maryland for a day trip. Like, take the bikes over that side and do some bike riding and get outside. It's my birthday on the weekend, so we're doing something for fun.
29 again?
Again, the annual celebration of turning 29. We were of course supposed to be in Italy. That didn't happen. so instead we will enjoy some stuff around DC too. We're going to go into the city and see some of my friends in a socially distant gathering.
So, well, you know what they say, this year in Maryland, next year in Italy.
So. That is the plan. We will still go, just not this year.
We do have aspirations, and we are planning as responsibly as possible, but I will say, for those of you all around this great big world, there are things in your backyard, reasonably close driving distance, that you can do in a perfectly responsible, socially distant way that are not your own backyard. I would highly endorse that strategy. Let's go outside and we will all become just a little less crabby than
totally. Take advantage of what's near you. It's worth doing.
Yes, well, we also in California now, we have color-coded maps of which counties are the best and which are the worst with regard to the pandemic. So it's like, oh, you know, it's not that far to drive to a place where, you know, people are not freaking out. So very cool. All right. Do we have a sponsor?
We do. This week, we are brought to you by PCmatic. Endpoint security built on a zero trust philosophy, allowing only trusted applications and blocking all the rest. Lightweight, simple to deploy, easy to manage. Find out about PCmatic's unique lead sharing program for MSPs backed by a primetime national TV campaign. Together, we bring advanced security solutions combined with more than sales enablement. We bring actual leads. You can find out more about PCmatic by visiting pcmatic.com/MSP.
Very good. Thank you, sir. And thank you to all of our sponsors. We certainly appreciate that. So our first topic today is kind of a regular feature, just because we get some regular data.
Tip of the hat to Paul Dipple and Service Leadership, as well as to Channel EDE, who does the webcast that broadcasts all this information on a regular basis. For those not familiar, Service Leadership is a group that does financial measurement of the solution provider space, have the world's largest database in regards to that, and do quarterly reporting around all of the financial reporting, you know, performance of solution providers. So they tend to do a lot of really interesting analysis of the space. I covered it on the Business of Tech podcast on the August 25th episode. So if you need to dig into some of the data, you can do it there. And we will also include a link to the webcast, which you can sign up with Channel ED and listen to the full report. I'm going to throw out kind of the data points, one or two of them that really stuck out for me that I wanted to throw to the guys and then hear what you guys are thinking. The first thing that really jumped out at me was the fact that they had highlighted how the best-in-class MSPs were moving a lot more users to the cloud. And in fact, those best-in-class had grown their cloud revenue by 18.2%, while the median and the bottom saw no change. So a trait of those best-in-class providers was the investment in cloud. The other thing that they noted was that for the first time, they normally always said, you know, regional differences were not a thing when it came to marketplaces. But for the first time, there was data different between the regions with the ANZ region. I'll say it localized for them. ANZ revenue was up and the EU and North America was down. Which is notable because normally they had sort of said like the whole world economy floated together. You know, hey guys, what were your, you heard the same sort of data that I did. What were you looking at as your interesting data points?
So for me, I've always been a little suspicious. I love Paul Dipple and I love this data, but I've always been suspicious about how representative it is. And after, you know, many years of graduate level statistics and teaching graduate level statistics, you know, there's an indicator that always jumps out. You know, in technology, if you tell me there's a problem with a modern computing system, I'm going to say, check the DNS, because the problem is always DNS. In this case, what bounces out to me is maybe it may not be as representative as it appears to be. And the number that really stood out to me is when he talked about the people at the bottom quartile, you know, the lowest performers, had a loss of an average loss of $100,000 in EBITDA in Q2. That just doesn't sound right to me. And so there's two immediate options. One is that the sample is just not representing the people that I've ever met. And the other one is that it is solidly representative of a group of people who are all automatically larger MSPs. Right, that what he considers smaller MSPs do not include the smallest MSPs.
Maybe.
Well, and that's the thing, right? That's the challenging part of this data, because I agree with you that it is not globally representative in a population share of what the entire channel is. But if there is representation, it tends to be of the much smaller type of the channel companies, based on my experience looking at that data. It has expanded, it has grown over the years to get a little bit better into the large and the mid-market solution providers, but there's a different slice of it that's also not representative. It is that it is almost, very heavily represented on MSPs and not other kinds of solution providers, other business models in the channel. But that led to what I thought was one of the most interesting takeaways in the data. Namely, that if you are an MSP, one of the things that stayed around and represented good growth and margin opportunity for you was your product sales in the pandemic. Right. If you look inside the data, those who do not have a strong percentage of product sales in their overall business model representation saw much more negative impact than those who have a broader share. Right. So if you get 50% of your top line from managed services contracts, you get 30% from product sales, 20% from project sales, that kind of a company where the heavy representation of product transactions was there to buffer, they had an overall smaller decline in top line revenue and in bottom line productivity. For so many years in this industry space, the religion of our industry has been, I don't want your dirty product sales. I don't like low margin transactional stuff. I am only here for the long-term recurring revenue contract services. I agree that that long-term contract is fantastic and sustainable. However, if you are doing the managed services and letting them buy product from somebody else, you are letting the fox in the hen house from a competitor's point of view, and you are begging that customer to evaluate other alternatives for product and service providers. Don't do that. And as we've seen in the deep, dark parts of this downturn and the uncertainty and the lingering recession that we're now dealing with, what people are finding is, I may not sign a new long-term contract with you, but I must buy and user devices and remote connectivity and security and. There is a tremendous uptick in spend on product. Please capture that revenue.
Well, the other thing to add into that, Carl, is there is actually an easy explanation that also describes what was going on. Because what Paul was also noting in there was that he was not factoring in like federal support money into that. It was noting, of course, the fact that those that were in the bottom quartile did not do as good a job of cost reductions. Those at the top were very aggressive on handling expenses. If you take both the fact that they were not course correcting fast enough on expenses and had federal subsidy money in there, and we know from other survey data, like from SolarWinds, talking about the large proportion that did apply and got it, those two factors will actually show a bottom loss significantly more than you actually lost in cash.
And he did mention that, you know, a lot of people in this industry, and I think it's more overrepresentative at the bottom, or the smaller companies, they're just not going to fire their friend Bob, right? Like, sorry, Bob gets to stay even if I lose a little bit of money, because I believe that this is going to be over and I'm going to need Bob when it's over.
Well, right. And so, and they had the money to do it because they were funded that way. Now, the other thing I want to observe is, and before I'll let it, Ryan, then I'll let you go, is the forecasts for Q3 and Q4 are slightly worse than April, but not much. And most are counting on a Q4 recovery. I'm going to keep saying this. There's no data, people. There is no data that says a Q4 recovery, yet most are in this sample set are saying it will be a Q4 recovery. Yeah, not so much, everybody.
and you went exactly where I want to make sure we take this part of the analysis, right? It is one thing to say either you did or did not make expense reductions. You either did or did not retain your customer base. That's historical data. It can be analyzed and understood, but it is the question of where do you go from here? There is a prevailing assumption in our industry that apparently things are about to get better in Q4. And yet, if you follow the logic in what the best practice recommendations are in Paul's analysis, you need to make serious, significant, fast reductions in your cost of sales, cost of marketing, your operating expenses, and then the market will come back and refloat your boat. Not if you don't replace that headcount. Right. And because if you look at it, where the data shows that the significant reduction in headcount happened, as usual, was in the sales ranks. Okay, well, this is why my philosophy has been and continues to be, whenever something significant turns down in the marketplace, you need to have a two-phase approach: survive and thrive. You right. have to do what you have mm-hmm. to do to survive today, but you have to be ready quickly, aggressively to come back again. If you laid off 3 or 4 salespeople to get your numbers back where they needed to be, well, then you'd better have a plan today to rehire those people as soon as it becomes prudent. Because when that market comes back, I mean, if you're right and it does come back in Q4, congratulations. But if you don't have any sales reps to book that revenue, it's just going to go to your competitor.
A final bit of warning, because we got to move to another topic. But the other thing that got passed over, I thought, fairly quickly was the number of days out and how so many people have gone from 27 to 45 days out. Your accounts receivable should be shrinking. And at the beginning, when it looked like we were about to pull the trigger and unplug the economy, I went out and did videos and told people, you must start collecting cash as quickly as possible, and you cannot have accounts receivable, because every dollar becomes less and less valuable over time until you have it in your bank account. And so going from 30 to 45 days out means you literally, instead of collecting 90% of it, you'll be lucky if you collect 80% of it. So, you know, start immediately right now. I believe in having zero accounts receivable. I don't think you should be any days out. And I think the idea that you should have an ideal, perfect goal of 30 days out is just bizarre.
You are not a bank.
Yeah, exactly. You are not a bank. And Carl, that is the most tangible, practical advice we can give on that topic. I appreciate you ended there.
Very good. So topic number two, Apple has a new privacy policy. And Dave and I totally disagree with it. So Brian needs to be the tiebreaker. But Apple is putting out what they call a new privacy policy that says, we're not going to share where you go and what you do with these other advertisers. And so we're going to use that ourselves. We're going to manipulate what you see. We're going to manipulate the ads.
See, Carl,
we're not going to share that with others, and we're going to call it protecting your privacy.
Well, let me say there's it's more subtle than you're saying. Because what Apple is doing is they are making it that when you have an app, you must opt in to providing the unique device identifying number that is used for marketing purposes, that it's no longer a default opt-in, you must specifically opt in. And so what Facebook put out a very ominous warning going, everything is about to break on our advertising model. But it is putting that choice into the consumer's hands, as opposed to assuming a positive response, and you have to back that off. Now, look, do I think Apple is doing this in a way because it's good for them business-wise? Absolutely, I totally believe as much. But they have chosen to take the high ground on privacy as a feature that people that buy into the Apple ecosystem are now buying privacy as one of the features there. Apple is delivering on it. They have the advantage of not being an advertising driven model. So it's really easy for them to go over and go, yeah, we're going to take all this capability away. Oh, and it happens to be bad for Facebook.
So again, as you say, that's how they're painting it. And, you know, just full disclosure, I own Apple stock, but I don't necessarily think that this is a 100% beautiful move to make the world spin in the right direction.
No. Right?
And I will agree with that. Everything that Apple does is designed to increase Apple's bank account, and they're very, very good at it.
Which is why I own the stock.
Exactly. That's why they are the first $2 trillion business on the planet, right? But remember, this is not the first move in this direction from our friends at Apple. They started a couple of iOS generations ago with, you know, everybody has a privacy mode, an incognito mode, whatever, right? Most of those are not actually private. All of that data is still being captured. It's just a question of, to Carl's point, who gets to make the decision about what gets shared and when. I am fundamentally in favor of putting it back into the user, the consumer's decision bucket, and say, if you want to do this sharing because you believe that it gives you more relevant advertising, that it increases the accuracy of your search and the relevancy of the information that's shared with you, cool. If that makes your life better, opt in, do the right thing for yourself, and everything works as planned. The single biggest takeaway I had on this story was Mark Zuckerberg's response was unbelievably victimish. Like, oh, they're doing this to us. They're taking it from us. We're the victims here. Okay, my question is, at what point did anybody decide that Facebook, and not just Facebook, any of the digital advertising platforms, who decided that they were entitled to advertising revenue?
I have always told people, I build my own community, and I want people to pay to be in that. I don't build my community on Facebook or anybody else. Is that I believe it is what I call, you know, building a house on rented land. That means Facebook can change a policy and boom, my page is gone. My business model is gone. Guess what? Turnabout is fair play, right? If Facebook is building their business model on Apple's policies, Apple gets to change their policy and life is rough.
You got to make those decisions a couple of generations. Play chess, not checkers, right? But remember the value pitch that you've heard from Google, from Facebook, et cetera. Our data sharing makes your life better. you want us to share this information because it makes your online world more relevant, more accurate, more valuable. And that's why it's a service that we're providing for you. And it's good that we make money. Okay, prove it. Because if that's actually true, if your value, if you personalizing the advertising on my device is actually good for me, then it shouldn't be that hard for you to convince me to go back in and proactively opt in. But if you're saying to me, well, it's just not possible to get people to opt in, now I question your essential business value proposition, and I think you might have been feeding us a line for the last few years. live your own truth here.
I'm shocked they're feeding us a line. But look, I mean, again, as I said, like on this, is I think it can be both at the same time. Like, I do think Apple can be self-serving yet delivering on that promise at the same time, because they've just chosen a different business model. They're not in the business of selling ads nor of selling data. So they can position around a premium product that sells privacy. I mean, if you think about across the larger trend, what we're seeing more and more is people with money can buy out of the advertising ecosystem. You can choose to pay money and not get ads on all kinds of things. Or if you do not have money, you can be subjected to those ads. And that's what Apple is playing into.
Well, and again,
what's interesting is, at least for me, first of all, I opt into all of these advertising things because it does improve my life, I think. But also, like on YouTube, I haven't paid for YouTube because the ads are not enough of an annoyance for me to need to opt out. If there were more ads or they were longer or I couldn't click away from them, I might actually pay to not have those ads.
Interestingly, so, I pay to opt out on YouTube because it's...
And again, that's exactly the point we're trying to make. Make it the consumer's decision. If you like to see this stuff, cool, do it. If you don't, you'll pay money to get out of that. Do recall, everybody that's listening to us, that all three of us are very much on the record consistently on we like privacy and we think the industry ought to do a better job of protecting that. And we've discussed that globally as well as in local individual vendor implementations. If it increases privacy and puts the control back in the user's hands, I am all for that. And if it hurts your feelings as Facebook, then my answer is, hey, you just provide more value. You can make all the money you want.
And yeah, they make a bunch of money now.
Exactly. Do not cry for them.
Topic number three.
All right. Topic number three. So over the last couple of weeks, we've been looking at the topic of emerging technologies. We've been looking at hype cycles and lists from CompTIA and the things that the industry and that we think are, if they are not yet prime time, they are soon to be prime time trends that will drive your business and the relationships that you have with your customers. We are going to feature an article here that is, it's a responsibility check on some of the messaging that we put around this emerging technology. And it may actually give you pause in the way that you adopt it, in the way that you resell it, and the way that you are coaching your customers to understand new technologies, right? So the specifics of this article, and I found this to be not only very interesting from a technology, an emerging technologies point of view, but also from just the rigor of the academic research that went into this topic. So basically, the headline is, automation fuels anti-immigration fears. And then the subheads, once you get into this analysis, are that any technology that is built on automation will eventually reduce the number of legacy employment positions. And it is not a brand new phenomenon, but through the stages of history, any new technology that replaces human labor will require us to invent new jobs to do. In the meantime, people who have legacy jobs get nervous, they get defensive, and they look for a place to put the blame. Well, we've been speaking at length about AI, about automation, about data analytics, about all of this emerging technology that's going to have the net impact of reducing existing job opportunities. When we have that message go out, it is only responsible for those of us in this industry to acknowledge people hear that story and it makes them think about their own job security. We need to temper the messages that we deliver. Again, you've heard us for the last several weeks. AI is cool. Automation is good. We are excited about what's about to happen in technology. But as a provider, you need to appreciate the fact that when you bring automation to the marketplace in any form, you are naturally subtracting certain job opportunities. And people will look at you with suspicion when you do that. And you need to have an answer that says, here's how I can lead you to the future.
And it's funny because I'm gonna immediately point to, think of the vendors that serve the space that talk to solution providers. There are tons right now that talk about automation. And if you, they are scripted to answer the question, won't this mean that I'm gonna not need as many engineers? And their answer is absolutely. What that means is you're going to be able to take your existing engineers and make them more productive. What's implied but not said is that also means you're not going to need to hire as many. That is actually job destruction. Now, I think I could make a good, pretty solid argument that that is okay. And that in this case, it does allow you to use those people in different ways or hire different style of position. But let's call it what it is you are replacing the need to have manual labor with automated labor. And it, in one economic interpretation, that is job destruction. So let's acknowledge that, and how we have to understand that principle, that when we talk about automation with our own customers, they are hearing that message too.
Well, you know, it's interesting because as Ryan was talking about the history of all of this, historically, the people who feared that their jobs were going to be destroyed were always wrong. Like in at some sense, yes, those jobs disappeared, but other jobs, better paying jobs, less labor intensive jobs, less dangerous jobs magically emerged with each level of technology. And so far, what the only thing that we can look at is right now the number of jobs being created by automation versus being destroyed by automation. And it looks like the number of jobs being created far exceeds the number of jobs being destroyed. Yes. The interesting thing is that we have a changing demographic in our country where, again, we don't want to get into politics, but you know, there's this ongoing fear of too many immigrants. Well, we're going to be importing human beings into this country in very large numbers because the number of jobs we have is expanding and the number of people that we are, you know, growing, homegrown, is getting smaller and smaller. So
now let's acknowledge human beings are not widgets, and so we cannot move one human body from one job to another job instantaneously without thinking societally about the transformation that human needs to go through.
True enough.
And so, you know, and obviously we need to think about that as a society. So if we're creating more jobs and we need people for them, we have to either train our upcoming workers or help existing workers transition to those new jobs. That, by the way, does require an investment. And yes, that is part of the cost of the transformation. So you cannot just say, like, you know, if you are the builder, right, of the automation, you're not necessarily responsible for that, but know that it happens.
True enough. And one of the things that's interesting is, you know, I think every roommate I had in college was an engineer. And the thing that happens with engineers is you go to school for 4 years and you learn enough so that when you get an actual real job as an engineer, you spend 6 to 8 months learning how to actually be an engineer in the real world, right? And that's actually merging into what is happening now, is that people are trained to a certain point, but then, you know, you go to work for almost any new company and they're training you on technology that didn't exist when you started your training.
That is absolutely
true. There has to be on-the-job training. I think we're doing more of that than we ever have, and we will continue that trend. So I think that answers at least a piece of that, Dave.
Well, but that, yeah, you're, see, again, I think you're correct there, Carl. And that's why when I started this, the distinction is between legacy jobs that will be destroyed versus future jobs that will be invented. There is a massive requirement in retraining, to borrow one of Carl's least favorite buzzwords in the industry, upskilling your human being. I said it. That is the industrial transformation process that has to occur. Now, A, in the small pieces of that function, there are new jobs that need to be created for training people to use these new skills. But beyond that, I agree with your analysis, Carl. Eventually, the new technology invents jobs that we couldn't even imagine before, right? There once was a time in human history where the only way to get a pile of rocks from here to there was to have five or six really strong guys pick them up and move them over there. And then we invented this thing called the wheel, and we attached a barrow to it, and you only needed one guy to move that same pile of rocks. Well, what are the other four guys spending their time doing? Not moving rocks. And that's good. And they really enjoy the new gig a lot more than they enjoyed the old gig. And that pattern repeats through history. We are on the precipice of, I will say it again to make sure that I'm hitting all the hot buttons here. We are on a digital transformation ledge. I know, I'm all the buzzwords today, right? There is tremendous acceleration in technology that's about to occur, and our population is woefully unqualified to be those people. Now, industry will tell you, find them where you can, import them if you must, manufacture them as a last resort. We need people with skills, and I think that's an exciting opportunity. It also speaks to bring this back to a very practical place for channel companies. This comes back to you as a solution provider. Your customers want all this new technology. They will benefit from all of this automation. They do not have humans on staff with those skills. You do. You can provide these for a fee on a contract or on a project. You get to choose your business model, but please build these future skills into your staff and sell them as a service.
That's what everyone's going to be hearing for the next days. For a fee.
Everything for a fee. Very
for
cool.
A fee.
Well, this was a fun little half an hour. Thank you for spending it with us. And that will bring to an end episode 76 of the Killing It podcast.
Thanks for tuning in to the Killing It podcast. Please share with your friends and tell everyone to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, and all the podcast places. Join us next week and help us keep killing it in the technology business.